Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Paul Turov Goulaire, and welcome to tonight's lecture, the first of the UCD, the inaugural UCD Abbey Theatre Shakespeare Lectures. My name is Jane Grogan, and I'd like to thank you, first of all, for coming to what promises to be a very interesting evening. And I hope you'll join us in celebrating the launch of this new series at a wine reception afterwards, kindly sponsored by the UCD School of English Drama and Film. Before I introduce our speaker for the evening, I'd like to say a few words and introduce the lecture series itself. In setting up these lectures with the hope that it would become an annual series and a regular date on the Dublin cultural calendar, we had a couple of ideas in mind. First, it presented an opportunity to team up with one of the most important national cultural institutions and try to bridge the gap between the university and the National Theatre, and more generally between Belfield and the city. And I know a lot of you here are alumni. That's exactly the kind of bridging that I think we need to be thinking of. It was an opportunity, too, to open our research, to open out the research we do at the university, and particularly in English literary studies, to wider audiences. But we also hope that this series would enrich a national conversation about who we are and how we imagine our world, a conversation that in the days of what was called the Celtic Tiger and what has recently bewilderingly become Brand Ireland has sometimes seemed pretty impoverished and reactionary or unduly cynical about what the arts, or indeed the universities, have to contribute. Shakespeare has much to offer us, and not just the recognition that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophies, but rather a treasury of enabling words and ideas, of humane thought, of political critique, of sympathy, and of agency, I think. And Ireland has always been present in Shakespeare, just as Shakespeare has always been present in Ireland. In fact, a whole host of early modern writers were physically present in Ireland in Shakespeare's day, serving the crown. And we shouldn't be surprised that Shakespeare looms so large, or that Ireland looms so large in Shakespeare's imagination. And when James VI of Scotland came to the throne in 1603, he's supposed to have complained, looking through the paperwork, that Elizabeth had more ado with Ireland than all the world besides. And from this side of the Irish Sea, it's hard not to agree. And we continue to live with the legacy of Elizabeth and James's plantations, the division of the country into counties, and so on. And the poet Derek Mahon has a brilliant short poem addressing this phenomenon of Ireland in 16th century English imagination and experience. And he picks up on one of the most famous and most reworked lines. Raleigh does it, and Herrick does it, a bunch of other people do it. One of the most famous lines in 16th century poetry, "Come live with me and be my love," and a line that usually invites the speaker's lover to lounge by the river on a sunny day. And he resituates it in Penshurst Place, which is the English country house of Sir Henry Sidney. Sir Henry Sidney was twice Lord Deputy of Ireland in the latter half of the 16th century, and he was father of the poet Sir Philip Sidney. And Mahon kind of recontextualizes these famous lines in a striking couplet. The first stanza of the poem ends, "The iron hand and the velvet glove, come live with me and be my love." And we really, the Irish context really comes through very strongly in the second stanza, where he sticks with these rhyming couplets and that really kind of ominously evoke the violent realities sustaining English pastoral ideals. And he draws, very obviously, you'll see the iconography of Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen, the moon-like Virgin Queen Cynthia as well. So the second stanza goes, "A pearl face, numinously bright, shining in silence of the night. A muffled crash of smouldering logs, bad dreams of courtiers and of dogs. The Spanish ships around Kinsale, the screech owl and the nightingale, the falcon and the turtle dove, come live with me and be my love." But how has Shakespeare been present in Ireland, especially as he's not one of the cohort like Sidney and Spencer who did spend time here? And here I think we're fortunate in having some really excellent recent work on the field. And I'm thinking of Patrick Lonergan and Deirdre McFeely's database chronicling pretty much all the productions of Shakespeare that happened in Ireland between 1660 and 1904. And that's available on the web. I'm also thinking of Stephen O'Neill and Janet Clare's excellent edited collection of essays on Shakespeare and the Irish writer, published by UCD Press a couple of years ago. We might also think of the eminent 18th century Irish editor of Shakespeare, Edmund Malone, whom I mentioned, and from whose 1794 Dublin edition, printed at 93 Grafton Street, his Dublin edition of Shakespeare's collected plays and poems, we've borrowed the illustration of the Globe Theatre as the emblem for this series. I don't know if you saw, but Michael Boyd, the artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, made some kind of off-the-cuff remarks recently in the Scottish context that post-independence Ireland had turned its back on Shakespeare. And I think that isn't really the whole story. We know that in the formative years of the Irish state, groups as diverse and divided as the Unionists of Trinity College, the Nationalists of Patrick Pearse's Coláiste the Aonair, and the founders of the Abbey Theatre, with their mission to create and nourish a new national theatre, all made a place for Shakespeare. And of course, there's a variety of reasons for that, but one of the most persistent reasons seems to have been this idea that Shakespeare was a sort of double agent within English culture, and could be made to speak for Ireland if indeed he didn't already. And if we're looking for evidence of Shakespeare's importance for Irish writers, we don't have to look very far. In fact, I haven't looked very far. Just last month, my father and I went to a production, the Millennium Forum Derry's production of Frank McGuinness's Carthaginians. And I was struck by the way in which Dido, who's this kind of mercurial, shape-shifting figure at the centre of the play, generates so much of his powers, both to divide and eventually to reunite, directly through the figure of Autolycus, this kind of snake oil salesman in The Winter's Tale. Just last night, in fact finishing tonight, I'm sure some of you have heard on Radio 1 Stephen Ray reading from James Joyce's The Dead. It's from Dubliners, which is the book chosen for One City, One Book this month as well. And at one point in the story, a discombobulated Gabriel Conroy is waiting outside the door for the waltz to end, fretting about the speech he'll deliver later that evening and some quotations within it. But let me quote. He was undecided about the lines from Robert Browning, for he feared they would be above the heads of his hearers. Some quotation that they would recognise from Shakespeare or the melodies would be better. And Gabriel's partnering of Shakespeare with the cherished Thomas Moore of Moore's Melodies, even though it's disdainfully evoked here, is quite revealing. And Shakespeare, it turns out, is already in the room where the waltz is happening in the form of two small pieces on Shakespearean themes woven by Gabriel's Aunt Julia that are displayed behind the piano, on the wall behind the piano, kind of quietly overlooking all of the rituals of death in life that are being celebrated in the room. Of course, there's plenty more Shakespeare in Ulysses, particularly in the scenes where Stephen Dedalus discusses Hamlet with his fellow students outside the National Library. All of it's very quotable. Our national poet, Shakespeare, our national poet, the Jewish-Irish Leopold Bloom calls him, or the man who writes like Sing, as Buck Mulligan has it. But I think in a way that Shakespeare's place in The Dead, kind of a quieter but more lingering, persistent place, is more symptomatic of his place in Irish culture more generally. Shakespeare restitched, reabsorbed, recirculated in the social, domestic and artistic currents of Irish life. So, taking a cue from the Mrs. Morkan, I hope that over the coming years, the UCD Abbey Theatre Shakespeare Lectures will help to restitch, reabsorb, and recirculate Shakespeare in Ireland, to reinterrogate our history in Shakespeare and Shakespeare's history in us. But enough for me, and apologies for going on. It's a great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker this evening, Professor Kiernan Ryan. It's very hard to know where to start listing Kiernan's qualities and achievements. He is an emeritus fellow of Newhall College in Cambridge. He's professor of English language and literature at Royal Holloway, University of London. And he spent time teaching and researching at various top European as well as English universities. His research has been concentrated first and foremost on Shakespeare. And he's the author of a string of important books and articles, including his seminal book Shakespeare, which is currently, I think, in its third edition, which is practically unheard of for a book of criticism. And most recently, Shakespeare's Comedies. And just to give you a taste of the importance of his work, a recent review of Shakespeare's Comedies opens with the phrase, "I find it impossible to imagine a more brilliant book about Shakespeare's comedies than this one." So this just to give you a bit of a sense. Kiernan has also done work for the BBC Radio and Television and has been invited to give lectures all over the world, and I'm delighted to welcome him here. Among his many achievements is one that he probably doesn't regard as an achievement at all, and that's having supervised me through my PhD. And as a supervisor, Kiernan was, I was going to say, unfailingly supportive, and I was lucky enough to be able to benefit up close from some of the qualities that characterise his work. His seriousness of purpose and attention, his astonishing breadth of reading and knowledge, and most of all, and that for which he's I think, best known, his intellectual rigour and brilliance and his commitment to the highest standards. And I know that we're going to see all of this in action this evening. So let me now invite Kiernan to deliver the inaugural lecture of the UCD Abbey Theatre Shakespeare Lectures on the topic Shakespeare's Universality, the Revolutionary Imagination.
Thank you very much, Jane. I must begin by saying what a great privilege it is and what a real pleasure it is to be invited to give this, the first of the annual Shakespeare lectures here, especially at UCD, and especially in this, this splendid auditorium. And I hope that what I have to say this evening won't be altogether unworthy of the occasion. The twin paradoxes that still bedevil the interpretation of Shakespeare's plays and the justification of his supremacy were first framed in 1623 by Ben Jonson in the poem he supplied for the First Folio. To the memory of my beloved, the author Mr. William Shakespeare, and what he hath left us. That phrase emphatically bolted onto the poem's title by Jonson, and what he hath left us, defines Shakespeare's drama at the start of its voyage through time as a legacy whose significance and value it's our task as the dramatist's heirs to determine. As far as Jonson's concerned, Shakespeare's preeminence as a playwright is self-evident and the reason for his apotheosis beyond dispute. Jonson praises Shakespeare as the epitome of his birthplace and nation, as the sweet swan of Avon and the wonder of our stage. Yet he's also a playwright to whom all scenes of Europe homage owe, who belongs not only in the front rank of his English contemporaries, but also in the international pantheon of the mighty Greek dramatists and their continental heirs, and thus to the world. Jonson's equally keen to hail Shakespeare as the soul of the age, the essence of the era in which he wrote. Yet he also acclaims him as an immortal monument without a tomb, the star of poets, who is, famous phrase, not of an age, but for all time. Local, yet global, rooted in the past, yet perpetually present, the double paradox through which Jonson defines Shakespeare's achievement still sets the agenda for debate 400 years on. The trouble is that Jonson's complex grasp of the matter has been ditched by most subsequent critics, who've polarized into two hostile camps, each of which labors under a lopsided view of the response Shakespeare's drama demands. On one hand, we have those who are wedded to the notion of a transcendent bard, whose plays have triumphed in translation all over the world and withstood the trials of time because they express with matchless eloquence and dramatic power the unchanging truths of the universal human condition. On the other, we find those who insist that Shakespeare is definitely not for all time, but of his age, and that to uproot his writings from the time and place from which they sprang and treat Shakespeare as our contemporary is to rob them of their revelations about a vanished world that is radically different from our own. For most of the last four centuries, the transcendent bard has undoubtedly prevailed over the time-bound bard in critical quarters. From Samuel Johnson to Coleridge to Leavis to Harold Bloom, Shakespeare's ability to shake off the shackles of history has found powerful advocates. Nothing can please many and please long, wrote Dr. Johnson, but just representations of general nature. Shakespeare's characters, he went on, are not modified by the customs of particular places, unpracticed by the rest of the world, or by the accidents of transient fashions or temporary opinions. They are the genuine progeny of common humanity, such as the world will always supply and observation will always find. In the writings of other poets, a character is too often an individual. In those of Shakespeare, it is commonly a species. For Coleridge, our myriad-minded Shakespeare is the great ever-living dead man because he is of no age, nor of any religion or party or profession. The body and substance of his works came out of the unfathomable depths of his own oceanic mind. Coleridge attributes Shakespeare's perennial ubiquitous appeal to the creative capaciousness of his mind, what G.K. Chesterton would later call his mental hospitality, while Dr. Johnson ascribes it to Shakespeare's faithful recreation of the common human nature he observed around him. And Harold Bloom can be found peddling the same line as Dr. Johnson 200 years later, at the end of the 20th century, in Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, whose first chapter is defiantly entitled Shakespeare's Universalism. I say defiantly because Bloom's bestseller is, amongst other things, an assault on the historicist criticism that still holds sway in Shakespeare's studies today, and that insists on anchoring the plays in the age in which they were written. Shakespeare has become, Bloom maintains, the first universal author, replacing the Bible in the secularized consciousness. Attempts to historicize his ascendancy continue to founder on the uniqueness of his eminence, for the cultural factors critics find relevant to Shakespeare are precisely as relevant to Thomas Dekker or George Chapman. Bloom's objection to historicist accounts of Shakespeare, on this ground at least, is hard to refute, since even the most comprehensive recreation of the culture that cradled both Shakespeare and his fellow dramatists couldn't begin to explain why Shakespeare's plays have bewitched the world, while theirs are seldom or never performed and of interest only to academics. The critics Bloom excoriates remain undeterred, however, by what they see as his reactionary last-ditch defense of universal Shakespeare, and they continue to call the shots in Shakespeare studies. Nor is it difficult to see why, if one concedes the force of their case in its most politically committed form. For there's no denying that the idea of Shakespeare's timeless universality has been used overwhelmingly in the past for conservative ends, to make class society, patriarchy, racial divisions and colonial domination vanish behind the smokescreen of an all-embracing human condition rooted in our essential human nature. Whereas to read Shakespeare historically, so critics of this camp contend, to return his plays to the milieu that moulded them and embed them in the class-divided, patriarchal, white Western culture of their time, is not only to confront their complicity with that culture and shatter the myth of their timeless universality, but also to restore Shakespeare's distance and difference from us, and thus both the historical fact and the future possibility of change. Which is why, in academic circles at least, to talk of Shakespeare's universality and transcendence of history has become taboo. As Leah Marcus wrote back in the 1980s in her manifesto for what she called localizing Shakespeare, Shakespeare's universal temper and oceanic mind have been enshrined for so long that these concepts, once so thrilling for readers and critics, now function less to preserve the vitality of the figure we call Shakespeare than to condemn it to slow asphyxiation, unquote. Along with her fellow historicists in the States and their critical counterparts in Britain, Marcus proclaimed the demise of the transcendent bard and the birth of a bard steeped in history and thus vulnerable to political critique. And at the close of the 20th century, David Scott Caston, in his Manifesto for Shakespeare Studies in the 21st Century, called for Shakespeare's scholars to entrench his plays even more deeply in the past, to restore Shakespeare's artistry to the earliest conditions of its realization and intelligibility, to the collaborations of the book trade in which the plays were published, to to the unstable political world of late Tudor and early Stuart England, in which the plays were engaged by their various publics, unquote. It requires no more than a glance at the catalogues of most university presses and at the research projects that secure doctoral and postdoctoral funding to confirm that this objective, in one form or another, still sets the main agenda for Shakespeare studies. Now, I've no wish to deny that the conquest of modern Shakespeare studies by historicist criticism has much to commend it. Its exponents have enriched our understanding of Shakespeare and his world by plugging the plays back into neglected cultural contexts and exposing their collusion in, as well as their resistance to, social, sexual, and racial oppression in their time. And in the process, they've dealt a severe blow to the complacent cliché that Shakespeare's drama enshrines the abiding truths of the human predicament. But in dealing that blow, they've sentenced Shakespeare's plays to languish in the prison house of the past, where they're doomed to speak only of what they once meant in a world that no longer exists. Trouble being that this retrospective approach to Shakespeare is powerless to explain his expanding appeal over the past four centuries to the most diverse cultures across the globe, a global appeal that owes nothing to knowledge of the historical context in which the plays were written. Of course, the cynical explanation offered for his drama's enduring supremacy is its efficacy as an instrument of ideological indoctrination and cultural imperialism, rather than in any exceptional virtues of the work itself. But seductive as that argument might sound, I don't think it'll do, not least because it still can't credibly account for such a vast amount of critical and creative energy being invested by so many different cultures for so long in the works of Shakespeare rather than in the works of any other author of any era. The question of what sets Shakespeare apart and why he remains the keystone of the canon and the touchstone of literary value around the world is still in quest of an answer. If it's not because Shakespeare dramatizes the perennial plight of all human beings everywhere, and if embedding his plays in the alien epoch that engendered them can't explain their refusal to stay put in their time, then we need to search elsewhere. I want to suggest that we take a fresh look at the discredited concepts of Shakespeare's universality and timelessness and see if we can reclaim them. Because if we could show that the quality of timeless universality in a progressive sense is inherent in the plays, genetically stored in their language and form from the start, then we'd have a much more compelling rationale for radical reinterpretations of them on stage and screen and in secondary and higher education. The idea that there's something universal and timeless about Shakespeare's drama has, after all, proved remarkably resilient over the last 400 years, and recent academic attempts to dismiss it as a moth-eaten myth have failed to persuade the vast majority of the world's Shakespeare lovers, for whom the idea continues to have the ring of self-evident truth. And the fact that it does should give us pause before putting it down to gullibility or ignorance. The reason why it still rings true to most students, theatre-goers and performers, I believe, is because it describes an effect the plays have on them, an effect they recognise as a property of the play's poetic language and dramatic form. That Shakespeare's plays possess, as has been widely agreed for centuries, a timeless, universal quality is not the problem. The problem is the conservative construction that's been placed on this quality and the reactionary purposes to which it's been put by conservative critics and by conservative cultural and educational institutions since the 18th century. So insofar as the wrath of militant anti-universalists has been directed at this conservative conception of Shakespeare and dedicated to demolishing it, they're plainly to be applauded. For it's unquestionably been a crucial factor in what Dennis Kennedy calls the enforced study of Shakespeare in Britain and America, which has long been used to support traditionalist notions of class distinctions, the merit of high art, the social worth of advanced education, and the value of the arcane. And it undoubtedly underpinned the importation of the bard into the farthest reaches of the British Empire, and particularly the Indian subcontinent, as a demonstration of the linguistic and cultural superiority of the conqueror. Yet the briefest exposure to facts suffices to dispose of the delusion that Shakespeare's drama is universal in the sense that it appeals equally to every nation on earth. As Kennedy points out, quote, "Any approach to Shakespeare that inquires about his prevalence in world culture is obliged to notice that he is not valued everywhere. Claims of Shakespeare's universality cannot be substantiated, at least on a literal level, since there are numerous areas in which he is not read, performed, or studied with enthusiasm. By the enormous populations of the Islamic countries, for instance, in much of Southeast Asia, in most of Africa, and so on." But the claim that Shakespeare's drama is universal because it reflects the human condition of everyone who does read, perform, or study it, regardless of their nationality, race, age, class, gender, or sexual orientation, is equally unconvincing, because obviously untrue, and its employment to mask inequality and injustice of every kind has rightly been condemned. When Jane Smiley rewrote King Lear in her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel A Thousand Acres to retell the story from the demonized daughter's point of view, she made it plain that her prime target was Mr. Shakespeare's alleged universality, a myth, that is, concocted to pass off the patriarchal point of view as the common plight of humanity. So, let's be clear, if the criterion of universality is giving equal representation to the experience and viewpoint of every group in society, so that every reader or spectator can find their counterpart in a character with whom they can identify and in whose fate they can in some way see their own mirrored, then it's a criterion that Shakespeare's drama spectacularly fails to meet. On these grounds, iconoclastic assaults on Shakespeare, like Smiley's, and the academic drive to tether him to his time are quite justified and long overdue. And it's easy to see how readily this attitude can slide into the thinly veiled contempt expressed by Franco Moretti in his classic study of Shakespearean tragedy, Signs Taken for Wonders. Quote, "It should be clear that this Shakespearean poetry has nothing liberating or universal about it, but is just Shakespeare's response to the crisis of class society in his time and the tragic disenchantment it produced." But I think that what's really tragic is that these justified assaults on misconceptions of Shakespeare's universality and attempts like Moretti's to explain it away historically as a rhetorical illusion contrived to preserve class society never paused to wonder whether the plays might have possessed this quality all along in a quite different sense. There's a vital distinction to be drawn between the reactionary concept of universalism and the revolutionary universalism that first found full philosophical and political expression in the Enlightenment, but which, I'd argue, had already found imaginative expression in the plays of Shakespeare, as that most bardolatrous of political philosophers, Karl Marx, wasn't slow to recognize. This revolutionary universalism is dramatically and poetically articulated in Shakespeare's most powerful plays, which reveal the potential of all human beings to live according to principles of freedom, equality, and justice. And it's revolutionary because the fulfillment of that potential implicitly demands the complete transformation of the terms on which people lived in Shakespeare's day and still live in our own. This profound commitment of the plays to the universal human potential to live otherwise is the secret of their proven ability to transcend their time. It's what drives their radical dissatisfaction with Shakespeare's world and divorces their vision from the view of things that prevailed in his time, opening them up to the future and the prospect of the world transfigured. That prospect, the tidal pull of futurity that inflects their form and phrasing at every turn, is what propels Shakespeare's plays beyond the horizon of his world to speak with more authority and power than ever to our own. The timelessness of the plays springs from their refusal to make complete sense in the terms of their time, which they view from the vantage point of a future we ourselves can only imagine. It's not that Shakespeare's quintessentially Elizabethan and Jacobean plays miraculously dissolve as we watch or read them to reveal the primordial bedrock of human nature that persists beneath the surface of social change. On the contrary, Shakespeare dramatizes the intractable reality of his world in such vivid, sensuous detail, in such unprecedented depth, and with such articulate energy that the plays transport our imaginations back to the age in which they were written, an age whose indelible imprint can be traced in every line. But he dramatizes that early modern reality in a way that reveals the potential it harbors for transformation and the capacity of human beings to live according to principles which possess universal validity because they're based on the fact that we belong to the same species. Ben Jonson's praise of Shakespeare as both the soul of the age and yet not of an age, but for all time, as both the epitome of his birthplace and nation and global in his impact and significance, proves fully justified from this point of view. Shakespeare captures the soul of the age in his plays in a way that transcends his age because he writes about his age from an imaginative perspective that's ahead of his time, not confined to it. And insofar as that universal perspective is still ahead of our time, Shakespeare's dramatic dispatches from the past, that distant past, still have the power to activate visions of alternative futures today. Or to put it another way, Ben Jonson's Augustan namesake couldn't have been more wrong when he wrote what I quoted earlier, that Shakespeare's characters are not modified by the customs of particular places, unpracticed by the rest of the world, or by the accidents of transient fashions or temporary opinions. They are the genuine progeny of common humanity, such as the world will always supply and observation will always find. What the good doctor should have written is, Shakespeare's characters are so vivid and unforgettable precisely because they are modified by the customs of particular places and by the accidents of transient fashions and temporary opinions. But they are dramatized from the perspective of common humanity, from the future perspective, that is, of a genuinely universal human community, no longer disfigured by division and domination. Coleridge caught this anachronistic aspect of Shakespeare's art, its alienation from the age in which it was written, when he observed that Shakespeare is as unlike his contemporaries as he is unlike us. In other words, the tragedies, comedies, and histories are out of sync with both Shakespeare's epoch and ours, and so can't be completely explained in terms either of the past that produced them or the present in which we encounter them. As I noted earlier, Coleridge, like Dr. Jonson, has been a rich source of quotations for critics keen to buttress the conservative version of Shakespeare's universality. But in fact, Coleridge has something much more intriguing to say about why the glovemaker's lad from Stratford has lasted so long. Shakespeare, says Coleridge, writes not for past ages, but for that in which he lives, and that which is to follow. It is natural that he should conform to the circumstances of his day, but a true genius will stand independent of these circumstances. It is a poor compliment to a poet, Coleridge adds, to tell him that he has only the qualifications of an historian. What allows Shakespeare's plays to stand independent of the circumstances of his day is not their portrayal of an essential order of things that never changes, or essential human types, such as the world will always supply and observation will always find, as Dr. Johnson puts it, but the dream of that which is to follow. When we engage with imaginative writing, Coleridge explains, we wish to have a shadow, a sort of prophetic existence present to us, which tells us what we are not, but yet, blending in us much that we are, promises great things of what we may be. The plays of Shakespeare cast the shadow of that prophetic existence, and it's in this sense that Shakespeare, as Coleridge beautifully puts it, shakes off the iron bondage of space and time. While he registers what is past, he projects the future in a wonderful degree. The other great romantic critic of Shakespeare, William Hazlitt, latches onto this prophetic propensity of the plays too. Chaucer most frequently describes things as they are, he writes, Spenser as we wish them to be, Shakespeare as they would be. But it's Hazlitt who makes the connection between the future towards which the plays are reaching and the democratic thrust of Shakespeare's dramatic imagination, between their refusal to remain confined to their time and their universal quality. Quote, the striking peculiarity of Shakespeare's mind was its generic quality, its power of communication with all other minds, so that it contained a universe of thought and feeling within itself and had no one peculiar bias or exclusive excellence more than another. He was nothing in himself, but he was all that others were or that they could become. He not only had in himself the germs of every faculty and feeling, but he could follow them by anticipation, intuitively, into all their conceivable ramifications, through every change of fortune or conflict of passion or turn of thought. There was no respect of persons with him. His genius shone equally on the evil and on the good, on the wise and the foolish, the monarch and the beggar. Now, once the bardolatrous hyperbole has been filtered out of these remarks, two crucial intuitions remain that point to the revolutionary nature of Shakespeare's universality. The first is latent in that phrase about his mind's generic quality, its power of communication with all other minds. Now, this strikes me as a really productive idea, because it redefines Shakespeare's universality as a capacity for communication, for creating and addressing a community of minds united in a common cause. The implication is that Shakespeare's universality is not a property of his subject matter, but an effect of the perspective from which he presents it and invites us to perceive it. In other words, it's not that the story of Richard II, Hamlet or Prospero secretes the universal story of mankind. It's that their stories are told from a virtual point of view that cuts across the distinctions and divisions forged by history, nationality, race, gender, or sexuality. So when we're watching Twelfth Night, Antony and Cleopatra, or The Winter's Tale, we're not seeing the common condition of humanity in all times and places, which a Buddhist monk, a cleaning lady from Cologne, or a transsexual trucker from Tehran would all recognize as their own. What we're seeing is an irreducibly singular drama about these idiosyncratic individuals who speak and act in distinctive ways and in forms of language that stamp the play as a unique product of the place and time in which Shakespeare penned it. But that drama is designed in such a way as to activate our awareness of the common human potential we share with the characters to live more fulfilling lives than those we find ourselves compelled to live by the place and time we happen to inhabit. Let's not forget Hazlitt's second key intuition, which is summarized in that sentence, his genius shone equally on the evil and on the good, on the wise and the foolish, the monarch and the beggar. Shakespeare's power of communication with all other minds, the power to ignite an awareness of the potentiality universally possessed by humankind, is indivisible from the democratic attitude of his drama. The characters of Shakespeare's comedies, histories, and tragedies inhabit imaginary worlds which are just as class-divided, misogynistic, racist, and heterosexually biased as the Renaissance reality they transmute into poetic drama. How could they not be? But these worlds are dramatized from a prospective vantage point, grounded in the recognition of the fundamental equality of all human beings. The plays invite us to view the way things were in Shakespeare's time from an egalitarian standpoint that's still ahead of our time. This standpoint is forged first and foremost by Shakespeare's keenness to exploit the polyphonic possibilities of his dramatic medium more fully than any of his contemporaries. Shakespeare expands the multivocal mode of composition to give a voice to Hamlet and the gravedigger, Macbeth and the drunken porter, the monarch King Lear and the beggar Poor Tom, to Duke Theseus and Bottom the Weaver, to anti-Semitic Christians and the Jew Shylock, to Henry V and a disaffected foot soldier on the eve of battle, to the exiled Duke Prospero and his slave Caliban, whose island he stole. Women and men, the ruled and the rulers, servants and masters, the foreign and the native, gods, witches and fairies, the vicious and the virtuous. The right of utterance is distributed across the spectrum without privileging any point of view or set of values over the others. So that, even though the mind, speech and deeds of the characters are fated to remain in thrall to social division and sexual injustice, the play as a whole creates the prospect of equality and community for the audience. Through their structure, form and phrasing, the plays grant us a foretaste of the unfettered dispensation their protagonists are denied, despite the startling premonitions that sometimes flash through their speech. For an example of the vision implicit in the whole play becoming suddenly explicit in a character's speech, we need look no further than Shylock's retort to the Jew-baiting Christians in The Merchant of Venice. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. The villainy you teach me I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction. In this stunning speech, Shylock rebukes his tormentors on the grounds that they share the same physiology, faculties, feelings, and needs, which render them equally vulnerable, equally mortal, and equally disposed to avenge the wrongs done to them. His arraignment of their anti-Semitism invokes a concept of equality that indicts every form of inhuman discrimination, making this speech one of the most trenchant protests against prejudice ever penned. The bitter irony, of course, is that Shylock is determined to vindicate the compassionate principles to which he appeals by violating them through revenge. But the concept of equality invoked by Shylock to justify his vengeance eclipses the vindictive purpose for which he enlists it, projecting the vision of the play as distinct from the viewpoint of the character beyond the Elizabethan age in which it was written, making it as much a play for today as a play for 1596. Shakespeare places a speech with a similar scope and impact in the mouth of Desdemona's maid Emilia. On the cliff edge of the catastrophe, just before Othello enters to murder Desdemona in the belief that she's cuckolded him with Cassio, mistress and maid fall to talking about the rights and wrongs of committing adultery. And after cheerfully confessing that she'd have no compunction about cuckolding her husband if she stood to gain enough by it, Emilia launches into a passionate defense of wives driven to adultery by their husband's mistreatment of them. But I do think it is their husbands' faults if wives do fall. Say that they slack their duties and pour our treasures into foreign laps, or else break out in peevish jealousies, throwing restraint upon us, or say they strike us, or scant our former having in despite. Why, we have Gauls, and though we have some grace, yet have we some revenge. Let husbands know their wives have sense like them. They see and smell, and have their palates both for sweet and sour, as husbands have. What is it that they do when they change us for others? Is it sport? I think it is. And doth affection breed it? I think it doth. Is it frailty that thus errs? It is so too. And have not we affections, desires for sport and frailty as men have? Then let them use us well, else let them know the ills we do, their ills instruct us so. The direct echo of Shylock's speech is unmistakable. Emilia bases her protest at the sexual injustice to which women are subjected by marriage in a patriarchal society on the same irrefutable evidence of consanguinity that Shylock adduces to upbraid his abusers. The argument she mounts is the realistic response of a worldly wise wife of her rank, conversing informally with her mistress, woman to woman, about the woes of married life in this period. But once again, while the immediate purpose of the character and the cultural context of the exchange remain rooted in their historical moment, the egalitarian rationale of Emilia's protest affords us a view of the plight of women that points beyond that moment, allowing us to judge the way things once were, and in too many ways still are, from the way they could and should be. The way love between men and women could and should be is unforgettably foreshadowed in Romeo and Juliet, that sublime tragedy of young lovers doomed by an ancient family feud, a fate which could hardly mark the play more unmistakably as the product of the epoch in which it was written. Yet the tragedy lives on and flourishes on stage and screen and syllabus across the globe because it envisages the possibility of love between individuals that's truly equal and mutual rather than an instrument of coercion and subjection. In Juliet's wonderful words, which you perhaps recall echoed as a refrain through that marvellous movie Shakespeare in Love, "My bounty is as boundless as the sea, my love as deep. The more I give to thee, the more I have, for both are infinite." And there's no more devastating assault on economic and social injustice in the language than King Lear, which forces an omnipotent monarch to feel what the poor naked wretches of his kingdom feel, and to recognize that beneath his royal robes and a beggar's rags beats the heart of the same poor bare-forked animal. Through Lear's traumatic transformation, the play demolishes the concept of innate social difference that supports all forms of class society and the unequal distribution of wealth and power on which class society depends. It climaxes in a snarl of contempt for all who arrogate to themselves the right to impose their will on others. "There thou mightst behold the great image of authority, a dog's obeyed in office." And in place of institutionalized greed, exploitation, and oppression, the tragedy advocates a compassionate, egalitarian ethic founded on the kinship of all human creatures. So distribution should undo excess, and each man have enough. At such moments in the plays, the universalizing imagination that covertly governs them finds overt expression. That imagination is implicitly at work, I've suggested, in the way Shakespeare pushes the polyphonic possibilities of Elizabethan drama to the limit, sharing the right of speech democratically between the diverse dramatis personae. But its impact is amplified by the pervasive theatrical self-consciousness of the plays, by Shakespeare's insistence on reminding us that the play we're watching is a play. I don't just mean his obvious use of the play within the play device, such as the mousetrap in Hamlet or the farcical performance of Pyramus and Thisbe by Bottom and Co. in A Midsummer Night's Dream. I'm thinking also of his character's habit of highlighting the fact that they are actors performing scripted roles, as when Juliet says as her death draws near, "My dismal scene, I needs must act alone." Or when King John realizes in that astonishing line, "I am a scribbled form drawn with a pen upon a parchment." And I'm thinking too of all the disguisings, both social and sexual, to which Shakespeare compulsively resorts. Portia as the lawyer Balthazar in The Merchant of Venice. King Henry V as a common soldier at Agincourt. The aristocrat Edgar as the deranged beggar poor Tom in King Lear. To say nothing of the countless soliloquies, the asides and direct addresses to the audience, the choruses and prologues, all of which flaunt at every turn the frank theatricality of the events unfolding before us. The concerted effect of these features is encapsulated in remarks such as Antonio's in The Merchant of Venice. I hold the world but as the world, Graziano, a stage where every man must play a part. Or Duke Senior's in As You Like It. This wide and universal theatre presents more woeful pageants than the scene wherein we play. Their effect is to sharpen our awareness that all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players, the same understanding that's enshrined in the motto traditionally ascribed to the Globe Theatre itself, totus mundus agit histrionem, or the whole world plays the actor. The fact that all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players has become an arthritic Shakespearean cliché, routinely cited to sum up the transience and vanity of human life, shouldn't blind us to the subversive implications that this view of men and women and the world harbours and that Shakespeare's drama exploits to the full. For Shakespeare's plays are intrinsically charged with the recognition that the real world is indeed like a theatre in which people assume the identities and perform the roles and speak the language and feel the desires and live the lives and suffer the deaths scripted for them by the world and time in which they happen to find themselves. There's nothing fixed or immutable about the way things are in that world and time, and nothing to stop human beings assuming completely different identities, performing entirely different roles, and living, loving, and dying on altogether different terms under other circumstances, in other kinds of society, in other times. Nowhere, of course, does Shakespeare say this like that, or expressly contend through a character that such is the case. But his plays enact this knowledge. They dramatize this understanding theatrically and poetically. In so doing, they achieve what Bertolt Brecht defined as the aim of all revolutionary art. They use every resource of language and theatre at their command to depict contemporary reality in such a way as to reveal that it's not the only reality possible, that how things have been until now is not how they have to be, that other forms of life are desirable and imaginable, and that men and women have had and still have the power to make those more desirable forms of life a reality. If all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players, then quite different social realities can be mounted on the stage of history, and the parts currently being played in real life, whether male or female, beggar or king, can not only be exchanged, swapped round, but also replaced by roles and relationships and forms of community which have yet to be imagined, but which the universal human potential to be otherwise makes possible. That revolutionary insight may never find abstract, discursive expression in Shakespeare's plays. But when King Lear perceives the same poor bare-forked animal, the same unaccommodated man beneath a mad beggar's rags and his own royal robes, and he strives to tear off the tawdry trappings of majesty, crying, "Off, off, you lendings," to become the classless human creature they conceal, the thing itself, Shakespeare stages that insight with a dramatic, graphic immediacy no abstract discursive statement could ever match. In a similar way, through the cross-dressed heroines of As You Like It and Twelfth Night, Rosalind and Viola, whose mercurial identities blur the boundary between male and female, the disparities on which patriarchy and orthodox versions of sexuality rest are playfully exposed as cultural constructions beyond which lies the possibility of identity and desire unfettered by prevailing distinctions between masculine and feminine, and between heterosexual and homosexual love. And again, it's a possibility that's performed, not explained, and that's utopian, not in the sense that it's absurdly unrealistic, but only in the sense that its desirability and legitimacy are not yet universally acknowledged. Both Shakespearean tragedy and Shakespearean comedy are generated by this fundamental conflict between the prevailing and the possible, between the divisive constraints of the hierarchical age in which Shakespeare wrote and the universal human potential, and thus the universal human right, to live free of such indefensible constraints. When Lodovico rushes in too late at the end of Othello, just after Desdemona has been murdered, and asks, "Where is this rash and most unfortunate man?" Othello replies, "That's he that was Othello. Here I am." And the whole tragedy, indeed the essence of Shakespearean tragedy, is contained in the gulf that yawns between those two pronouns, he and I, between the jealous Moor Othello, the part that history has condemned him to play, and the potential self that fleetingly survives to testify that such heartbreaking fates are not inevitable, but the result of man-made circumstances that can and should be changed. If Shakespearean tragedy dramatizes the triumph of the actual over the possible, of the way things are over the way they could be, Shakespearean comedy dramatizes the surrender of reality to the sway of desire, making the utterly improbable appear entirely plausible by bringing it to pass before our very eyes. The art that accomplishes this is above all an art of implication, which persuades through design and demonstration rather than through argument. And nowhere is it more persuasive than in A Midsummer Night's Dream, in which Shakespearean comedy took a quantum leap, creating something richer and stranger than the English stage had ever seen before. Previous romantic comedies had revolved around the amorous imbroglios of their aristocratic protagonists, relegating lower-class characters to cameo roles as witty slaves or servants confined to subplots or ancillary scenes. But in this visionary play, the ruling class lovers are elbowed aside and forced to give equal room not only to supernatural creatures to whose existence they are oblivious, but also to rude mechanicals that work for bread upon Athenian stalls. This expansion of the comedic perspective to accommodate the voices, views, and values of the ruled on an equal footing with their rulers creates a leveling dramatic vision which subverts the hierarchical principle that dictates the relationships and destinies of the dramatis personae. Nothing, however, captures the egalitarian spirit of Shakespearean comedy more vividly or memorably than the centerpiece of the whole play, the moment when a common working man becomes the pampered consort of a queen, while a queen is reduced to a tradesman's concubine and her royal spouse is cuckolded by a clothmaker. Bully Bottom, with the braying head of an ass, unfazed and completely at home in the adoring arms of the fairy queen Titania. It's the most extreme instance of social inversion, the most exquisite glimpse of hierarchy dissolved and transcended in the whole of Shakespeare. And it's a perfect illustration of the way in which Shakespeare's drama, as Henry James observed, renders the poverties and obscurities of our world in the dazzling terms of a richer and better. It's undeniably true that at the end of A Midsummer Night's Dream, male and female characters alike, the highborn and the lowborn, the mortal and the immortal, remain locked inside the oppressive structures and relationships that created the conflicts that the comedy strives to resolve. In that respect, A Midsummer Night's Dream, like all Shakespeare's plays, is inextricably of its age, the inalienable progeny of early modern English culture. But at the same time, Shakespeare's prophetic dramatic imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, giving a local habitation and a name to the utopian possibilities, the alternative realities already germinating within his world. And in this respect, Shakespeare's drama reaches far beyond its time and is still able to awaken in us, 4 centuries later, a desire which only a radical transformation of our own world will satisfy. Which is why, at this moment in history, when rapacious globalization has produced millions more houseless heads and unfed sides than Shakespeare himself could ever have imagined, and the need for distribution to undo excess that each may have enough is more urgent than ever, it matters to reclaim and activate the revolutionary significance of Shakespeare's universality and refusal to stay buried in the past. Shakespeare's bequest to us, what he hath left us, as Ben Jonson put it, is an extraordinary power. A power to view the past that shaped the present as if we were already citizens of centuries to come, citizens of a truly global community for whom the dream of universal human equality has at last become a universal reality. Thank you.
Thank you.